Hey, movie lovers, welcome back to another Anatomy of Movie here on Popcorn Talk. So you want to be a Sicario? Well, let's talk. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Anatomy of a Movie.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Today on Anatomy, we are talking Sicario, Day of the Soldado, as it is here titled in the United States. Takes on other forms, Sicario 2, you can call it, or Sicario 2 Soldado. Either way, it's the same movie. Dimitri Panos is here.
Hey, Phil, welcome.
Yes,
and
indeed.
Hello, movie fans.
I'm Phil Svitek. Missing in action today is Marissa Serafini, much like Emily Blunt from the first movie.
What? That was awesome. That was good. Like how you tied it in.
Absolutely. This is the follow-up. Apart from our two main characters, not a lot of things remain the same in the sequel.
No.
If you want to kind of call it that. It's more of a... They've been quite open about it. It's an anthology. But before we get into any of that, first we must welcome you, the listener, the viewer. We appreciate you.
And
a couple
welcome.
Things to note. We are spoiler-filled. We assume that you've seen the movie, so now's your chance to tune out before we get into all of that. Secondly, if you want to follow along with our rundown, by all means, there's a PDF in the description box. You just click it. You follow along. Our show is a little bit different than most shows. We don't just review it. Of course, we're going to talk storyline and all that. Like most people, but we're going to also talk about the how and the why, and more importantly, how they actually put it all together, the behind-the-scenes aspects of it, and there's a lot of cool stuff going on here.
There is.
So without further ado, before we kick into any of it, we have to give our overall impressions of this movie. Dimitri, what did you think?
Hey, well, you know, you brought up something that was really interesting, and I think it's one of the more interesting aspects of this movie is that it isn't a direct continuation of the first one. This is a completely different movie, in its set of tone. Mm-hmm. The first one was, you know, really downer in a sense, right? It was just very deep and heavy. It's Denis Villeneuve's director. We have a different director this time,
and cinematographer.
Yeah, much different. Yeah. Movie still looked good though.
It did.
I mean, listen,
it did.
This isn't a Deakins movie, but it's still like it still had those landscapes, Western type landscapes, which we'll get into when we talk about Taylor Sheridan. But I like the fact that they're making standalone movies, and I like that this was different. This one was is a little bit more it's predicated more on action than it is on mood. I felt the first Sicario was very heavily predicated on its mood, right? This one, there's far more suspense. And there are a lot more action set piece shootouts than the first one had. With that said, you know, I wasn't a big fan of the first Sicario. I understood why people liked it, got it. I wasn't necessarily there with them. This movie, I felt it was okay as well. Mm-hmm. I felt its third act for me is where it suffered the most. And I was like, where's this going and why? And then there is a believability factor. There's something that happens that, you know, we'll talk about it to the Sicario. And it was weird because I felt too, for a movie that's Sicario, there wasn't a lot of Sicario doing the Sicario things that I had hoped would happen in this movie. Again, Josh Brolin is having this amazing year. Like,
yeah.
Right. I mean, think
he
about
it. He is on a
this.
Roll. And just within like
such
3 to 4 months.
But such a role where I thought he was one of my favorite characters in Deadpool 2.
Mm-hmm.
He plays Thanos, obviously. He's in this wonderful, underappreciated movie called Only the Brave, mm-hmm. About these firefighters, these four firefighters. And he's amazing. And he's been very good in each of these roles. And again, he turns out another top-notch performance here. I mean, this guy is not phoning in a performance, and I give him all the credit in the world. He's having a really fantastic, I think, year. I hope it keeps rolling for him. Benicio del Toro is always fun to look up on screen, especially coming off of DJ, Don't Join. You know, there was no lisp going on here as the Sicario. So, yeah, I really enjoyed the cast. We're going to have a cast member in a little bit later today.
That's right. Davidson. We will be doing a separate bonus interview for this movie, so yeah, stay tuned for that.
So very much looking forward to that. For me now, too, for me, one of the highlights is this Isabella Moner, who was in Transformers The Last Knight. And I really enjoyed watching her in this and that movie. This movie, I thought, this girl was fantastic. As Isabel Reyes, she was almost like as good or as captivating as that little girl that was in Logan. And I really feel that this Isabella Moner, she has a future ahead of her. I think, you know, when you can stand toe-to-toe with the likes of a Benicio del Toro, you know, and
in the subject matter more so. True. Like, you know, I think there's a lot of great child actors, but to do it with this subject matter, and Logan was of similar, you know, it was an R-rated movie, obviously it's a superhero movie, so slightly different in that sense, but nitty-gritty both, yeah.
Very nitty-gritty. And she was fantastic. Every time this girl was on screen, just captivated. She was that good. She brought an intensity and yet a sympathy as well. So to me, she was a real standout in this movie. So all in all, the movie is very tense. It is very rated R. You know, Phil, when I saw this movie, there were parents that took, kid couldn't have been older than 12. What are terrible. You doing? Right? I mean, this is a violent movie. I would say even more violent than the previous installment. It's interesting. It's going to be interesting to see where they go, especially after how this one ends, which we'll talk about the ending, I'm sure. I wasn't a big fan of. But in all, it was an enjoyable movie. It's very topical, which we'll go into that too. Well, I was on Meet the Movie Press earlier today, right? And we talked about that and about whether or not that has helped grosses or detracted from the grosses, because it is very topical for today. I'm not entirely sure that was intentional, being that it was written some years ago. So we'll get into that too.
Well, I think
it's very fascinating.
It's interesting. You can like no different than movies from, let's say, like even 1940, right? There's some movies that you can watch today and you can be like, that's so topical. Well, there's certain things that are timeless. And especially when it comes to sort of culture, perhaps racism and perhaps gender biases and all these are subjects that unfortunately still exist much, you know, we've made slight progress, but certainly, things aren't all well and good.
But this movie, and again, Sony, you couldn't have known. It's one of those coincidences, those movie release coincidences. You couldn't have known that, you know, border wall or border crossing would be the flashpoint topic in the news when this movie came out. Because that's a major part of what this movie is about. So, like, if you're Sony, you're like, at that point, you just got to roll with it and see, you know, and let the cards fall where they may. So it's just very interesting. And you're right. I mean, you're absolutely right. What's topical yesteryear can still be discussed today and bring into a new light.
Well, to me, what I appreciate most is the writer, Taylor Sheridan. I think he's really making a name for himself. I loved Hell or High Water. I think, you know, he's doing modern Westerns. When you look at, like, Justified, which was on FX, that was a modern Western-style TV show. I thought it was wonderful. And I think he's bringing it back to cinema. You know, and I don't need the old gunslingers, but I like this very slower-paced, very gruesome style of action and appreciate it. And I think he's got something to say. I may not always agree with it. It may, you know, but nonetheless, there's something there. And one of the things I appreciate is that he doesn't make it easy.
Yeah, no. And I couldn't agree with you more about this. Is it Tyler or Taylor? I think it's Taylor. Taylor Sheridan, right? That Hell or High Water was one of my favorite movies of last year. Justifiably so, is a favorite. It was a fantastic show.
By the way, it had nothing to do with that show, but just a point of comparison.
Yeah, and you're right that this one to me is more of a Western than the first Sicario. This one, and again, I think his writing, it works with whatever director he's, you know, like the director here really understood. Stefano
Somila.
Somila really understood Taylor's, like what he was trying to accomplish as far as the world of Westerns, right? And there are shots in this movie that look like they come from movies like The Searchers, right? And the landscape and the way that the story goes, moves along. It moves along like a Western, good guys, bad guys kind of thing. But he gets it as a writer. And you're right. Whether you agree or disagree, he can be very nitty-gritty, but he's always personal in a way. He has a personal element, and I think that is what works. That's what worked in Sicario, Hell or High Water, and in this movie. By getting to know these characters, he gives them a personality that, as an audience, you can sympathize with or really detest. But he's great at setting up a good character. And even though, like, Sicario can be a bad guy, you can root for him too. And that's where his writing really shines, is making it personal for the audience.
You know, any other movie I could see, you've got your main characters, you've got Brolin, you've got Del Toro, and then of course the girl. Then you have kind of, you expand the circle a little bit out to the U.S. government. And, you know, then you have the kid and, you know, that side of the cartel. But the fact that at no point in the movie do we ever go to Reyes, the father, and get his point of perspective, like, no matter what it takes, get my daughter, or anything of that nature, or that, you know, we don't have a viewpoint into our own Congress or whatever, saying, like, this is a frickin' disaster. Shut this down now. Right. We're very much secluded in that way. And to me, like, it is a very much heartbreaking story of... There's the great phone call between them in the middle, where he's like, "Listen, you know, we're not going to pick you up," and he's like, "Got to do what you got to do."
Right.
And they know, like, they have this unspoken friendship, but they understand that, like, their job comes before their humanity.
Job and or duty,
yeah,
comes before, right? Because is it the job or is it the duty to the job? That phone conversation that you talked about, too, I agree. I mean, you don't get to see this a lot in movies. And I think it only works because of the performers, the actors, really elevated the writing. They really made it shine. So you're paying attention. And the beauty of it all is they probably weren't even in the same vicinity of one another doing it, right? And they pull it off. You understand, and the way Josh Brolin performs that scene too, you get it, man. Like, he doesn't want to sell his friend down the road. He doesn't want this to happen. And then Benicio Alejandro on the other side is like, I understand. You know, it's like no hard feelings. I get it. But at the same time, he's like, but I'm going to make it work for it, kind of thing. It was one of the highlights of the movie for me, and really showed the acting chops of the two very fine actors.
Well, it also does help. This is their fifth movie together, so you know they have a good rapport.
They do, and
I'm sure that helps. You know, and one of the things that I thought works so well, I think it could have been slightly longer as far as his decision, but at the end when you could see his face, Brolin's face. I'm talking about. Not reacting and almost wanting a tear because, like, they confirm the kill, quote unquote. I'm being loose because, of course, it's not an actual confirmed kill, but Alejandro is down. And, you know, now they have to take out the rest of the cartel. And even just the decision to take Reyes, because he knows, like, listen, okay, I've screwed over my friend, or however he wanted to term him. So at least I'm going to honor what he was trying to do and save this girl. Because at the end of the day, she had no part in any of this.
Right. Yeah. And I would go as far as to say that there was a friendship there. There was a loyalty there. They each understood one another, and that meant for the rapport. I mean, you wouldn't tell a friend, "Hey, I'm in your living room right now. Don't fucking shoot me. Leave a note in your door, right? I mean, that was a really funny scene. And the way that that scene was set up, you're like, ooh, all right, something's going to go down. And when it ends with the post-it note, you're like, it let go of the tension and you're able to laugh. Friends would do that. And there is a mutual respect for the job that each one of them has. And they understand the role that they have to play. And they understand when somebody says, you can get dirty on this, who he immediately goes to, because he knows he can get the job done, but he also is trustworthy. So I do think that there was a friendship there.
Absolutely. I 100% agree. And, you know, you could look at it partly that he's exploiting, in a sense, his pain.
Mm-hmm.
And to a degree he is. But the fact that Alejandro never out of spite does the unthinkable, because he knows the pain of killing someone's child.
Right.
And he could have very easily done that. So in an odd sense, he's a better man than Reyes.
Well, yeah. But, you know, here's where I was a little... Here's where... This is a gray area of the movie for me, because the end... One of the final moments of the first Sicario, he does wipe out a family.
Mm-hmm.
Like, at their dinner table outside. Kids, if I'm correct, right? I mean, he wipes out the wife, the kids, and then he makes the guy watch it. Then
Steven,
he
you're
the
in
guy.
The booth. You recently just watched this. You want to fact check for us?
Sorry, what?
The
end of Sicario, doesn't Alejandro Sicario, doesn't he kill the entire family at the end of that movie? At the dinner table?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, and there were kids.
The dad begs him, he says, not in front of my son, and he pulls out his gun, just shoots everyone at the table except him.
Yeah.
And then while he lets him stew in his own little devices for a bit, then he shoots him.
Yeah. So, you know, Reyes is his
maybe he grew as a person.
Well, it does say he found a humanity, and that's one of the things too, in great westerns, that journey about finding a humanity. The Searchers is a good example. But, you know, not that I expected him to kill Isabella. But, again, it was one of those things. It's like in the last movie, he had no compunction, like, killing kids. And this is the guy you're going after. Spending the time with Isabella. And you're right. He understood. She was just born into this. And she still, like, has to fight. When we are introduced to that character, she's in a fight in school. Right. So I just think that, yeah, she was also going to be a means to the end. Like, she was going to get him back. Cause
well, I think that was a
great conversation, too, between I know who you are and things. So go ahead.
Well, that's what surprised me the most. Maybe because I've seen Rush Hour so many times that where the little girl there is more of a pawn and she's in the background. And, you know, this could lead us down a different way, and so I don't want that. But as far as the trailer, it gave a lot away.
In particular,
when they get ambushed by the Mexican army, let's say. I thought the way it was tracking in the moment, and because I knew the trailer, my mind started to piece wrongly things together. I thought she was the one piecing these things together and was going to somehow notify somebody, because she's like, wait, you were DEA, now you're this. What's going on here? And I thought she was very clever to pick that up, and I thought, you know, she would get it back to her dad somehow, and it would just blow up in America's face somehow.
Right.
Still does, but just not in the way that I thought.
Not in the way that we thought, but she was a very precocious, she is a very intelligent girl. She's observant is a really good way to describe that character. And again, the way that she was played, She's very brilliant. I think that she carries that movie, and she does so, and she's the one that helps elevate that relationship. And you need a strong actress of that age, because you have to see the humanity come through. You just can't have a cold-hearted killer all of a sudden, like, snap his fingers and, oh, okay, I feel bad. There has to be a reason why, and I think it was because of the way that character, Isabel, was played, that... Because if the audience can buy into it, then you understand why Sicario can buy into it, too.
Yeah, and what was nice is that he wasn't overly bonded with her. Like, it was mainly through his action. He only told her what he wanted to say, which was very little.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they didn't have, like, a whole heartfelt moment or anything like that. And just even the way he finds her after she runs away from that initial standoff with the Mexican army, he just shoots. He knows he's going to kill the person he's aiming at, but nonetheless, there's collateral blood, if nothing else. And she's like, what the hell?
Right. But the other thing, too, is that in a sense, she develops, by piecing things together, she comes to understand Alejandro in a way that maybe Alejandro doesn't understand himself. And she bonds to him as well. And she does gain a fondness for him, let's just say, you know. And I do believe that when he got shot, that was painful for her, the entire scene. I bought that, and I believed that relationship was not forced on the audience. I didn't find that it was cliche. I felt that it really worked, and probably one of the strengths of the movie. Some people I know disagree. They feel like, when the hell did the Sicario movie become a babysitting movie? But I felt it was a little bit more than just a babysitting movie. I really felt that the emotion was earned.
Absolutely. Yeah, I would not call this a babysitting movie in any sense of the word. I think number one, it was his task to keep her alive, and eventually, again, there is that humanity, as we talked about, both in terms of the friendship, but now both in terms of her.
Right.
I do want to shift gears to one of the bigger storylines that, you know, is kind of being set up but doesn't come to fruition until much, much later, is our friend who's an American, but now he's the cousin. And he's going to help now transport people because he knows the river. And as they tell him, entice him, you'll make more money than your father in 1 year.
Right.
And, you know,
Miguel.
And it's interesting, even that the woman, when they finally do cross the border, as she says, like, show me a job that pays more and I'll take it. You know, I think.
And she was an American. She was an American.
Yeah.
You know?
So you can understand where he's coming from, but, you know, this was a sort of a slow burn in terms of payoff. And then the way it ends, I think you're talking, you know, you were hinting at the ending. Yeah, that was the most surprising aspect of it for me.
Yeah, you know, Elijah Rodriguez plays Miguel. And, you know, I felt for me that character. You know, I don't like it was sort of a weak character for me. I always blame a director and or casting when you're putting somebody in somebody that young in a situation like this, because this is a heavy movie, and I just wasn't buying his toughness, even when he wasn't tough and he was pretending to be tough, and then he becomes tough and he does this. I wasn't buying his arc, and I'm not sure if, like, the director was just getting the best out of the kid. I'm not saying that the kid is bad. He has opportunity. But when he shows up at the end of the movie and he's all tatted up and he's got his hair slicked back, I didn't buy it. I just did not buy it. Well, I laughed.
So in that sense, like, when he jumps off the truck,
right?
I bought it as,
I'm done with this life?
Yeah, I'm done. Too. Like, you know what? I did this. I'm out. Whereas now with the ending, it reads, he's just saving his own neck, but he's going to join the next person. Like, he's an opportunist.
Sure. But he was, he's still.
But I don't buy him as an opportunist. Yeah, you're right. I don't buy him as that.
I didn't buy the character as that. I didn't buy him as that. And I didn't buy the Sicario, because he ultimately is the kid that pulls the trigger where we believe that Sicario is down or dead. And, you know, when Sicario hunts him out, what was it, a year later? I forget. Some months after, maybe not a year. I don't know. He goes, oh, so you want to be a Sicario? I was like, really?
Is he there to beat the shit out of him?
That's what I thought.
Like, so, like, basically it's saying, so you think you can be a Sicario, you little piece of shit?
Okay.
I thought, but then the way he closes, well, even just the door close indicates like, okay, you little piece of shit, you're not getting out of this damn room. There's going to be no weapons. Let's go. You think you're a tough guy, motherfucker? That's the way I read it. And I know I just dropped the budget, but this is Sicario, so I'm just going to go with it.
And see, that's how I would have liked to have taken that scene. That would have been bold. Like, okay. But I didn't read it that way only because of the way Alejandro in that line was delivered. I actually took it as, so you want to be a Sicario? Okay, I'm going to train you. And the door's shut, and I'm like, do I want that movie? Do I want to see? I go, no. I like your interpretation of the ending better. I wish I had walked away out of the theater, in fact, with that interpretation of the ending. Mm-hmm. That's curious. I didn't even.
Well, I get your sentiment. I get your sentiment, but the way the music, and we opened up with that very, you know, and it's got that build up, and I think our Sicario is so meticulous, he's not going to show anger. And in a sense, you know, it's like an animal toying with his prey. It's like, okay, all right, let's have some fun.
I like your interpretation better than my interpretation. I will say that. Hey, and I admit my interpretation's not always accurate, and it doesn't fit with a lot of other people, but I enjoy yours a lot more. I think it fits into it. But, you know, I wanted to talk about, too, about the Sicario character. Look, we already know that Benicio del Toro plays him great, right? But I felt he was more Sicario-ish, this assassin in the first movie, right? So when he was, like, up against the wall, I thought he was going to do something. It's like, you got these kids, basically, like these wannabe gangster kids, and I'm like, he can't just take these brats out. Like what? Like I just felt, since this movie too was a little bit more, was more predicated on the action, I just thought something.
Well, his goal at that point was to keep her safe,
right?
Which, you know, when you talk about the baby singing movie, maybe that's why people react to it in that way. Because that she's the primary objective for him.
Sure.
And he knows if he does anything,
her she life could get hurt. Yeah. Okay.
And that's not what he wants.
Right.
But so that's the way I interpreted it.
Okay.
I'm not saying it's right or it's wrong. It's just the way I read it.
Yeah, I just was like, why isn't he doing anything? Like, we know, especially when some of those people left the bus, I'm like going, I mean, he snuck on. Again, I'm going to the end of the first Sicario. The way he took out security guards and other people before he got into the family, I'm like, he was doing some pretty, like, he was doing some pretty heavy, like, combat shit that I was like, this guy's trained. He knows what he's doing.
Well, it could have been a better mental exercise. Because I think physically he knew he was beat, but they were kind of playing this mind game. Sure. And it just kind of feels like he lost the mind game.
Yeah. Which I have a hard time believing that character, especially how he was built up in the first movie.
Even in this one, like, he, you know?
Yeah.
Like, they made a very strong point to make these two movies so far be standalone. And I think it works as a standalone. Like, even without the first one, absolutely, you get his character.
Yeah, and it's a great point because you don't need. It was like none of the characters needed reintroduction, so to speak. Like, if you had you not seen the first one and you see this one, you already get the bond there, and you already know government, he's an assassin,
he's, and you get his cockiness too.
Absolutely.
Brolin says one of his favorite parts is, you know, when he's in the Middle East, he's just wearing flip-flops,
right?
And it just shows this arrogance that he loves, that he knows exactly what's going to happen, he knows exactly how he's going to do it.
Yeah.
And he doesn't need to worry about anything else.
Yeah.
So, yeah, just the way it plays out is they know 100% what they're getting into. To that point, you know, Emily Blunt, they very much took her out of the equation, not because she's a bad actress, but because she represented too much of a moral compass.
Absolutely.
That they didn't want, which I found absolutely interesting.
Absolutely. And that moral compass sort of gets shot at the end of the first Sicario. It's like, well, you can have your moral compass. but I'll kill you. Is more or less, you know, what happens there. You know, this movie could have benefited, I think, having a strong female presence. I mean, Emily Blunt is a fantastic actress. This one really, you know, Catherine Keener is great, but she's not in the movie a lot. And there isn't a woman who's part of his team, Brolin's team there. I don't know. It might have benefited a little bit to add something. And again, I understand why Emily Blunt's not in this in this movie. Her character's not even mentioned. It's because it is a standalone. You know, once you make that tie, right, then it becomes that kind of a sequel where somebody who may not have seen that, they're going to, who the hell is that? Why are they spending so much time talking about this person? They really don't talk about her at all. And we're just into the story now. So, and Taylor Sheridan Due, you know, he talks about, it's one of the things that you get too, is that he talks about this being, well, it is a modern, he's a modern Western voice. Now, are people craving this? I think when you do it in such a way where you sort of disguise the movie as like, it's a Western, but it's not a Western, like, that's when it works. Because people, if you make a flat-out Western, as much as I love them, some people don't gravitate towards them. But I think he has that modern day, and Hell or High Water is perfect. I think perfect about that. But, you know, he also has a finger on the pulse of this changing American landscape that's become highly topical today. And it's not about even just legalization of drugs. It's about how these drugs and how terrorists can come into the country. And he does it in such a way that he doesn't even really take a political side.
Well, his side, I mean, as far as Westerns, the side has always been that America's built completely on violence. So it doesn't matter drugs or anything else. You know, right. That's just the MacGuffin.
True.
But Western, the whole idea of Westerns that it showcases us as a very violent nation.
Yes.
And this, as far as, oh, we know exactly what's going on here. You know, terrorists were being smuggled into Mexico. Then they were going up here. Then they bombed Kansas. Oh, no, it just turned out to be Kansas people. You know what? Shut this whole thing down. We got to bury this. Mm-hmm. We're moving on. It's like, it's dark crap.
Yeah, let's talk about the... I think it's good to talk about the beginning, because the beginning sets up these things that initially don't seem connected. You go to movies as much as we do, you go, okay, why are we being shown this? Like, why are we being shown this at the border, then this at a big box store, that bombing, and then the taking out of extract
the information.
And it was very interesting how each scene was done very differently. They each very intense, but they were shot differently.
Almost like short films in a way.
They each had a beginning, a middle, and an end. They each had a different atmosphere. Like, mm-hmm. one's a store, like a popular Costco-ish kind of store. The other one's at the border. Like, why is this guy running away? And this string ties in through, and then, you know, the movie makes no bones about saying, terrorists are coming through via our borders. Like, these people are being walked in, and they're terrorists causing terror in our country. And that is the part that I'm talking about, like, topical today. What I loved is the movie took that turn and said, no, these didn't come from our country, morons. They're homegrown. Yeah. Like, now, what the reason was is why they blew up that box store, I don't know. But it really sparks, it ignites our plot as to where we're going. And when we turn out to be wrong in the assessment, well, who really admits that, right? But this government thing has to shut down because they don't want it to get back to anybody about what we've already set in motion by setting up a cartel drug war in Mexico. So that is where Taylor Sheridan's writing really works, to put all these pieces together and do it in a way you go, okay, this makes sense. And when that news comes down, you just go, oh, shit. Right?
Yeah.
Like, what's going to happen?
And
whose side am I on?
And what's great is that you don't go to that hierarchy of the decision making.
Right.
Because at the end of the day, it is, you know, you can obviously try to think of all the people involved, but it, you know, in a sense, a lot of people will talk about it. You distance yourself from that idea so you can make the best decision possible. Yes, it's utilitarianism more so than anything else, but now it affects Alejandro and Matt, and certainly Isabel.
Yeah.
And they're like, yeah, okay, but you're not really understanding.
Yeah, you're not getting who this affects. Like, not only did you set this in motion and you told me to get dirty, which I did, now I've got people, now I got to cut ties with people that helped us, yeah. That we, like, what? Oh, okay, just give her back.
And
nothing will happen.
Not that he was, like, pushy about it, but in their initial conversation, Brolin's character, Matt, he does say, like, you know what I do, right?
Yeah.
And to your point, he says outright, yeah, we want to get this dirty.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, as long as you know what that means.
Right.
Because I'm going to get dirty.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so, and I think they were happy up until a certain point. Like, everyone always wants you, yeah, no, that's what I want you for.
That's what I want, yeah. That's
until
why
it takes the slightest dip.
He gave them, like a limitless budget. Great scene when they're in the restaurant, when he's in the restaurant with that guy. To work out, like, he needs planes, he needs this. And he goes, well, how much? He goes, well, let's just say you'll be able to buy that hockey team you've been like, that was really, I like that scene about how he's putting everything together. So, you know, we were talking about, too, about how this movie looks, right? Mm-hmm. And the one thing is, it is predicated on action, but he did, well, there was one scene, one scene in particular was the drive through the desert, and there was the ambush or the double cross.
The return to Mexico.
The return to Mexico. And doing it through the windblown sand where you can't see, and then we talked, you and I, before we went on air, we were talking about the music. Mm-hmm. And how it really heightens the tension. That scene was done, like, really well. I knew something was going to happen. I knew somebody was going to double cross somebody or something. But it was leading up to it. It was done
extremely
well.
Well, it's uninterrupted.
Well.
There's the music. True. That's a layer.
Mm-hmm.
You have, obviously, great acting, which we've talked about. But then, as kind of, a lot of these shots were inside the Humvee. This is one in particular. And the quote goes, technically, it created a lot of problems because you can't shoot with multiple cameras and you're going to have a battle around you that needs to be seen through the windows. And you need to move the camera 300 degrees with long tracking shots so you can get an idea of the battle. But we learn and discover a lot more about her. So when they're talking about this and the way you're describing the scene, a lot of it goes uninterrupted.
Yeah.
And that's what creates the tension because, you know, that a cut is a respite for an audience one way or the other. And in that moment, you don't get that.
Yeah. And even Brolin's character says, I hate when we leave paved roads. Or something to that effect.
Yeah, pretty much.
So then, you know, you have the DP, Darius Wolski. And this guy's done Pirates of the Caribbean movies. He did The Martian as well. It's because of the way that was lit, the effect of the sand, the blinding, like your vision gets, you know, it goes from miles to like feet of visibility. And you're right. And with the music, it was just really well. There was a really very good extremely suspenseful theme or part of the movie. So I think they built up the suspense. There were suspenseful scenes in the first Sicario, and, you know, like I said, the cinematographer there was just fantastic. Denis Villeneuve is a really good director. But this one, the suspense was a little different. It really hung on, like, a lot. It drawed you, like, what is going to happen? What is, come on, happen already? I can't see. Right.
But, and even within that scene, everything kind of quiets down. The sand does settle, right. And they make it a very big point of like, hey, no, we're okay. We're on your side. Like right. We are the Mexican army. We're sorry. And not that they let their guard down, but they're very cautious. Boom, a shot's taken, and it's like, oh, you lied.
Done. Yeah.
Yeah. And part of the thing is there's no franticness. Not from the camera, not from the music, not from the editing, and not even from the characters. Like, when the girl runs away, they're not panicked. They're like, okay, listen, no. You guys go. I'll handle this. And he's not, like, rushing after her, like, gotta grab my stuff, gotta go. It's like, I'll find her. Well, not a big deal.
And to that point, Josh Brolin, his character has a great line where he basically, like, he just says, new mission. And they're like, okay, new mission. And, you know, it's to go get the girl. And you're right. It wasn't like there was this big rush, but it's like, where the hell did she go? And I was suddenly going to the girl. Where the hell are you going? but it was interesting that it was Alejandro who's going to go out and go get her. And is he going to go get her? Is that going to be his opportunity? But I still think that in a sense that he needed her to get to Reyes. Reyes was his white whale, so to speak. But then when he comes across the farmer, that was, you know, and again, whether you loved it or hated it, I actually thought, again, we saw a side of Alejandro that you don't normally see. And you know, why? Yeah, it's like, how do you know how to sign?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very strong connection, because even from the farmer's perspective, you see this guy with a gun. You've chosen to live in the middle of nowhere for a reason, whatever that reason may be.
It's not, right.
And, you know, there's this person, and all of a sudden, they're signing and they're communicating, and it's very gentle.
Yeah.
It brings a very strong connection.
Yes. It really does. And you're right. You lived out there, but you live out there for a reason, but he's still like, I know her. I know, like, who you are. Like, he too was able to, through observation, piece things together. But the scene was very gentle in the way in which he was signing. And at first it was like, hey, hold on. Let me explain. And I like the way that conversation evolved and how they ended up from being outside into going inside the house.
And it could have very much played it like he's the farmer's just doing this to kind of stay alive. But,
right.
And there's a part of him that could be doing that, but he's also, you know, they do care for them more than they needed to.
Right. Yeah. And speaking to that, too, producer Basil Iwanek said of Del Toro that he studied that script like incessantly, and he would continue to scrutinize it every night during filming. He's thinking about this movie 24/7, and not just his character. He was talking about Del Toro further. He says he's thinking about the entire movie, and he wants it to feel real, and he wants it to feel emotional, and he wants that to work. And sometimes when you have a movie like this, it's hard to make to balance the emotion and the feel up until the heavy action. But I think Benicio does it really well. And then executive producer Erica Lee goes on, and she believes that Alejandro will always be the soul, which is interesting because he's the assassin. He showed no soul in the first movie. He was prepared to take Emily Blunt's character out, right? And so here, now we have the executive producer saying he's always going to be the soul of these movies, and he's the heart that beats within. He is the protagonist and antagonist at the same time, which is, you know, well, she goes on, says that's non-traditional. I agree. It's a very interesting character. I'm going to be curious to see if and how he evolves.
Well, when we talk about the script and him studying it, I am quite impressed simply for the fact that the script overall had dialogue, and then as far a couple of action beats, from what I gathered.
Sure.
I have not actually seen the script itself, but I'd be very curious to know, you know, how you kind of – I think studying is more translates more to interpreting the script.
Right.
You know, and giving it your own flair. And obviously he quite well did that.
Right. I agree. And then on the flip side, you got Matt, played by Josh Brolin. And we see he's become a little bit darker. But another great line that he had is when he's talking to Keener, Catherine Keener, who plays his superior. And she's pulling the plug and says, "You got to take this guy down," which I didn't quite understand, like, why. And he, too, was trying to make the argument, why? Like, it makes no sense. Like, he's not going to. He was vouching for him. But when she says, "I'm going to set up a team to do it," he's like, "No, I'll do it. Because if you fail, if your team fails, he's going to come back and kill you." And I was like, "Yep, okay, go ahead." It was really great the way he delivered that line. And it also put more weight on him, like, yeah, I get it. How am I? You could see his thinking behind the eyes going, how can I maybe get around this? Mm-hmm. And because did you actually, like, I was thinking, like, if this was going through, he's going to figure out a way. I didn't think he was actually going to put him down.
I didn't, sense. But I didn't either. He was never given a choice.
True.
And I don't mean like not by Catherine's character, but more so. By the time they got to them, they were already in possession by the cartel.
Right.
And so, you know, whatever plan he wanted to use was out the window.
Right.
You know, he had to react instead of act.
Yeah.
And that was the deciding factor. Speaking of kind of, as you know, as we're talking about sequencing things, Matthew Newman, who is the editor on this.
Yeah.
He says, "Everything was about hiding things and about secrets. You never knew what was really happening. The first part of the film is very anonymous, and it's the first time that you see a face on screen. But the scene had to feel like you were in the same story, even though you didn't know what the story was." This goes back to, you know, what you were talking about, the three scenes. But the version we go was the best that Brolin did, his humor and his righteous anger in the kind of beginning. Like, there, you know, there's when, a movie like this has to have great pacing, and I think that's what they obviously talked about quite well and played with.
Oh, absolutely. This definitely was paced differently than the first one. Again, makes it a far different movie, tonally, pacing-wise. I mean, this is a two-hour-ish
yeah. plus change,
sure.
couple of minutes.
It goes by pretty quickly. Like, there's enough of those action and suspense scenes that carry it through that even when you have a lull, you're still getting over it, so to speak. And then you're engaged as to what's going on. So even the downtime, when we're at the farm, which is downtime, we've just left behind the carnage and the wreckage on that road. We're in Mexico. We're lost. It's welcome downtime. And it propels the story. So, yeah, I felt that the pacing in this movie was fine. Yeah. You know, spot on. I didn't feel it dragged at all.
Yeah, and we've been talking about the music in various forms. This time again, Johan Johansson did the score. However, tragic because the movie is dedicated to him because he deceased before it ever came out. So quite sad. I mean, he's done a lot of great movies. He's worked with Danny Villeneuve on a couple of them, in fact.
Two that we've talked about here, Sicario and...
Blade Runner.
The Arrival.
The Arrival.
Right.
But he also did Blade Runner.
I thought that was Hans Zimmer on Blade Runner 2049. Because I thought he had passed. But I know he did The Arrival. And where his strengths come in, I think, as a composer, is he's able to set a tone. We've always talked about this. You can set a tone and you can help build suspense. And this is where the teamwork comes in. Yes, you have a great director who has the vision of how the scene, like think of that scene driving those Humvees through that desert, right? So you got the director, you have your cinematographer, you have your editor. How are we going to put this together? And the music at this shouldn't overpower what's being taking place on the big screen, but it should heighten the tension. Even the beginning of the movie, when we don't really know where we are. We're at the border. Why am I at a Costco? Why am I over here? How are these things? But each that first 15, 20 minutes of that movie are very tense, and in major part because the music ramps up that tenseness, as the music itself ramps up with that sound. So, yeah, he was very good. He's, yeah, he'll be missed.
He will. He will. Unfortunately, tragic death, as I understand it, due to drugs. So, unfortunately, there's a PSA in that.
Yeah, and the thing is like, I will watch, listen to his score, enhance a movie, but they're not the kind of scores that I would sit down with a fine scotch and a good cigar to listen to relax. This is not the kind of movie score.
I think it's the kind of score that if Dimitri had an interrogation room, this is the score that he would play. Quite literally. Endlessly. I mean, it's yeah. So, but very good score. Del Toro describes it as, when I first heard the score, I felt I was hungry. Like, wow, what a clever move.
Yeah.
It's a good way to describe it. I know, I'm not sure how you interpret hungry, but
he's Benicio.
You know,
he's great.
Let's talk about the director, though, because this is his first kind of major movie, his first English movie. And I thought, you know, in terms of his style and so forth, I thought he pulled off it well. I'm curious to see what he's going to do sort of next.
I mean, he was the gentleman that did The Impossible, right? Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, right. The Impossible, which again built suspense for a story that we actually already knew. But not only did he film that tidal wave, the tsunami, and then having the family, because that's another journey movie as well. A family trying to find themselves and reunite after a major, major natural disaster. And again, here he makes a different movie. He does make, you know, I would like to see this guy film more of a traditional Western. Mm-hmm. I think he did a really good job. And again, Westerns rely not only on the journey and your characters, but your landscape. And he was able to fill that lens with some magnificent landscapes, the Mexico desert and all. Yeah, he's a very solid director. I think he did a really good job here, especially building suspense and then having a payoff action scene. Because they were action scenes. They were gunfight action scenes. And he really... sometimes in an action movie, if it's just pure action, you're going off adrenaline, not so much suspense, but he drew on that a lot. And I think he balanced and juggled it really well.
Absolutely.
He's a solid director. He knows how to frame a shot.
That he does. And overall, this movie did better than the first movie as far as opening weekend, $19 million, better than $12.1 million, which was what the first did. So I'm glad that people are receiving it, you know, well. And I mean, granted, it's got a 64 on Rotten Tomatoes, which isn't the best, you know, but...
You know, it's very interesting. And again, I know that, you know, there's just no way you could have predicted what's going on at the border and immigration and the immigration issues. I don't want to make this a political show, but that has to come into play when you're talking about this movie, in a sense. And again, Taylor Sheridan, when he sits down to write the script, immigration has been is an issue, okay? The release of this movie, it became a flashpoint issue. And it made me wonder, as I was watching it in the theater, how people in this day, in this particular day and age, how they were looking at this movie. Does the controversy, does what's happening in society, that the social politics of it all, does it hinder the growth? Does it propel the growth? Do people pay attention to what is being said in the movie? Do they make up their own judgments? Because the movie, I think, makes it clear. It's like, we fucked up.
The movie does, but I think going into it, you know, just watching it, you could look at it like, oh, it's stereotypical. We're going, you know, Americans fighting the cartel.
But it's the border crossing. It, to me, it was like, to me, it was holy shit. They're actually blaming illegals coming into the country and bringing terrorists. That's why they kidnapped that guy, because his boat would bring them to Mexico, so then they can cross over into cross the border into our country. And there are some people who would look at the first 40 minutes of the movie and call it a documentary, right? And that's the sad thing. But then the movie goes in a different way. But because of what's happening today, it's hard not to think about the situations in the movie. Like, if it, does that make any sense?
It does. Well, I think it is quite deliberate, and it is much like the ending. It's not supposed to be easy. Much like this, it's in a sense, make up your own mind. Like, because you look at, okay, obviously some of the people that cross the border, they're going to be good people and good citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's going to be some people who cross over and they're not going to be so good. But at the end of the day, okay, that's good, that's bad. But then we have us, and we're also not good. There's good sides of us, but we're also bad.
Yeah. And yeah, the bombing, the box store bombing was all us. And that's what precipitated this. So it was just very interesting. Like, had this movie been released, I don't know, a year ago, or I don't know what the, let's just say a year ago, right? Do you, like, you're watching the movie and you're like going, oh, wow, okay, that's an interesting plot point. Like, that's a movie, like, you look at it as a movie plot point. Today, you look at it as, Jesus Christ, this is what's going on, maybe? Like, is that where he's drawing his experience? Like, where does he pull this from? And I don't know. I think from a gross perspective, yes, it did. It over-indexed what it was supposed to do. But I wonder as well as if it's kept some people from seeing it, and has it kept some reviews from being better? Because maybe a reviewer, albeit they really shouldn't, in a movie like this, because this isn't a documentary, shouldn't be bringing the political slant to the movie.
Well, I think,
and just try to watch it as a movie.
I think any movie sort of about this, regardless of whether this was prominent, you could argue that then he's trying to make something prominent. There's a lot of movies that do something to bring something to light to a people or a subject matter that isn't necessarily given a voice most of the time. And so, you know, this just kind of... serendipitous is the completely wrong word.
No, but it was just a bizarre coincidence. Like, yeah. Again, I don't think any studio tries to plan the release around the blowing up of a building if your movie has a building that blows up in it. In fact, many a time, whether it be television or movies, they've either pulled back the release or they'll pull back the release or pull back the air date of the television series. Even movies like Spider-Man, the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man, they had to restructure their whole marketing campaign because of the 9/11 tragedy. You know, he was swinging from the towers, and they had to scrub those and rechange everything. So. Yeah, it's like no movie marketing hopes for that to happen. And I have to figure that they had picked their date maybe a year before, not figuring what the hell's going on. And then this happens. I would have to say there would have to have been some slight concern, maybe even panic, to go, is this going to help us or harm us? Let's just not even talk about it. Let the reviews say what the reviews are going to say. But we're not going to go out there from a publicity angle and say and make this topical, because it already is. So I think they sort of kind of played it right, and their marketing got people in.
Yep. Let the movie speak for itself. 100% agree.
Uh-huh.
Well, they, you know, I think there more than likely will be a sequel. I'd like to see a sequel, but one way or the other, it will be a new director, same characters but new story in essence.
Mm-hmm.
They are continuing, if they do, an anthology, and I appreciate that. So I very much would look forward to that. I think these movies are different. Not saying they're the world's greatest movies, but I think they are certainly good movies in a time where there's just so many franchises and
I agree. And, you know, it's a sequel, so can you call it a franchise? I agree with you 100%. I mean, it is different. It gives something. It's adult fare. Let's make no bones about it. This is adult fare. I mean, when I see a 12-year-old kid in this movie brought by a parent, it's like, what the hell are you thinking, man? You know, like, this isn't... It's violence has become a lot different than when I was growing up as a kid, but I'm sure the thoughts were still the same. But show a little responsibility. Like, this is a violent movie. Probably the most violent we're going to see this summer. Right? Mm-hmm. Right? Because everything else, Mission Impossible has its violence, and we see action.
That's PG-13.
PG-13. But this is a hard R. It was encouraging to see its grosses, because that meant, I have to assume, 17 and plus, an older audience was going to this. Interesting conversation I overheard to the people next to me. I know we have some limited time, but it was two couples, and one husband boyfriend. He said, "Oh, I saw the first movie. I really like the first movie. I'm really looking forward to this one." And his wife or girlfriend was like, "Oh, no, I'm in it for Benicio. I love my Benicio del Toro. That's why I'm here." That's great. Like, different reasons for wanting to see the movie. And my theater was crowded. And I have a feeling that the sentiment, man, woman, or whatever, was sort of similar. Mm-hmm. Saw the first movie. I just love my Benicio del Toro.
Fair enough. Well, let us know in the comments section whether it's the politics of it all, whether the storylines of it all, or just in general what we're talking about, why you went to go see the movie. Lots to discuss. So by all means, let us know. And then, if nothing else, a franchise like this, or these two movies, have kicked off Denis Villeneuve's career, in essence.
Sure.
Because then he went on to do, as we said, Arrival.
He did a couple of other movies prior, too. But yeah, no, he's very much so.
On behalf of D-Movies 1701 for Dimitri,
please
support him there.
Please. Yeah.
At Serafini TV, who is on vacation. She is not with us today, but feel free to interact with her in the downtime. I'm at Phil Svitek. Thank you guys, as always. We've got lots to look forward to. Ant-Man and the Wasp coming out next week. And if you're curious, we have a whole section, a whole library of past shows. So check those out. We'll see you next time for another Anatomy of Movie.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of its owners or principals.